My favorite song, Across the Universe. La 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 la.
Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither wildly as they slip away across the universe. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my opened mind, possessing and caressing me.
Microphone check, mic, microphone check.
Mic check, mic check, mic check. That's what I was testing.
Yep.
Yeah, it wasn't working either, so it was a good thing I tested it.
And the connection between us is fast.
Yeah. Oh, you can see it?
So I'm told. Well, just
a little part bar of meter.
You can do the test where you... In Skype, if you do the mic test in the same spot, you can hit test the connection before you call to somebody. But I've never had it come up as anything but fast.
Before. Even when it's slow.
Yeah. So it may be not doing anything.
Yeah, it's a feature in the software they never enabled.
Yeah.
It just hard-coded to fast.
Yep. That's work. That sounds like work speak.
Yeah. So how have you been?
Pretty good, man. It's good to talk to you. It's been about a month and a half.
Yeah, I was just looking for the episode number, and I'm like, Geek Brunch, Geek Brunch, Geek Brunch, Retro.
Yeah, there's been about three or four episodes of the regular show in between, but...
And that's bi-weekly.
Yeah. Yep.
So, but 6 weeks.
We're on track to... have 20 or a little over 20 episodes in a year. It's, I think we started last October, so that's not too bad.
That's not too bad.
All things considered, for a bi-weekly show, it's almost on target.
Yeah.
But, this is episode 19 then, I believe, right?
Yeah.
And, for those that listened to the last episode, but maybe don't already know, we talked about... the fact that we would be meeting up, and unfortunately that did not happen. I didn't make it to Baltimore Comic Con for some personal reasons, unfortunately. So that meetup will have to occur in the future, unfortunately. But you did make it and had a great time, it sounds like.
Yeah, it was a blast. It always is, though.
Yeah.
It's funny, the evolution of comic book, conventions, whereas I started at the Mega Con, right? San Diego Con.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went there, at least the first time, it was totally for me and getting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And now, as many years have passed, it's totally just going from meeting up with my friends, and the getting stuff is secondary or third objectives.
Yeah.
So.
Do you remember what year it was that you first went to San Diego, or?
I think it was 2003.
Okay.
And so every year after that, I've gone. So I've gone to something.
Mm-hmm. So this is your 10-year anniversary of con going.
Yeah. Well, I've gone to those small hotel things, but I don't count those.
Yeah.
Those are just vendors usually there to sell stuff, and you may get one person if you're lucky.
Yeah, we have, and I think I'll actually make it this year to the Buffalo Comic Con. It's just a one-day thing, and I think, so it's been going on for a few years, and I've missed it other years, because it hasn't always been real well promoted, but each year gets kind of better, I guess, as far as that goes. So I know actually ahead of time, it's about a month from now on a Sunday, and it looks like, you know, they're trying to slowly expand it. I'm sure it's a lot of dealers and stuff, but they do have, they don't really have anybody, you know, real big names, but they have like local people coming in, and they have like the local Star Wars group coming in, things like that. So I'm going to try to make it over there, check it out.
Yeah, the 501st or whatever.
Yeah, which the funny thing is I...
You really are a stormtrooper.
Yeah. So we had this new human resources guy come to work, get hired at work, and eventually I got around to meeting him and talking to him and stuff, and I went over to his office for some question I had, and I noticed that there was a drawing on his wall. It was like, looked like a little kid had drawn it, and it was of Darth Maul.
Yeah.
So I asked him about it, and he told me his son drew it for him, and he said, you know, they have no choice but be Star Wars fans, and I said, oh, why is that? And it turns out, you know, he's a huge Star Wars fan, and he actually leads up the local group, and like makes, he's when they make appearances and stuff, he's Darth Vader. So that was pretty cool to find out, because I mean, I'm aware that there was a group in the area, because they do, I think probably the most prominent thing that they do is they do you know, the local AAA baseball team does a Star Wars night every year.
Mm-hmm.
And they put on like a whole scripted show after the game. Matter of fact, this year was actually a continuation of last year's. So from one season to the next, they carried the storyline. Like, I guess last summer, the story, you know, the event ended with Luke Skywalker getting captured, and they left it on a cliffhanger. And so this year was the continuation of that and his escape and stuff. So sounds like they do a pretty good job, and kids really love it and stuff. So,
yeah. I think there's a local chapter everywhere. Even here, we have a small one. They showed up at our con is really small. It's more of a toy con, because most of the vendors bring toys, but they always show up. Like, that's where I took my picture of Chewbacca, and which is really cool, because you don't usually see Chewbacca too much. You usually see tons of stormtroopers, a Vader, and then Princess Leia.
Right.
Maybe a Han Solo.
Yeah, I never get this. I mean, my favorite is Yoda, and I never get to see mine because, you know, it's hard to find. I asked him, you know, if they ever had a Yoda, and he said, no, the kids are always looking for Yoda. He said, if we could find somebody of the appropriate height to be Yoda, you know, it's kind of hard to find an adult.
Why does it have to be the appropriate height? All you just need a guy to be on his knees for the most part.
Yeah, that's true. They could maybe hide it under a cape.
Right. He's hidden under the cape, and he walks on his knees. But then when he's tired, he just takes off everything and then stands up.
Yeah. Or like Yoda could always be just like levitating over a Dagobah rock or something.
Yeah. They have high expectations for their cosplayers, too. Like, everything definitely has to, they have standards and stuff they have to meet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you could be like a Elseworld stormtrooper. I don't know.
Yeah, I would imagine not. But if I ever feel like amputating my legs off at the knees, I have a job as Yoda.
Yoda. Or you walk around on your knees.
Or that, but, you know, I want to show my dedication.
Yeah.
To mutilate myself for the cause.
I don't think I'd ever do that.
No. I think I'm going to be able to get a picture with Darth Vader at least, so that'll be cool.
Yeah. There was a good Vader at Baltimore Con that I took a picture with Alan, and Alan was scared of him. You'll see it in the picture if you saw it.
I think I did see it, yeah, because I was... First couple of days of that weekend, I kind of just stayed off Facebook because I was bummed that I wasn't going to be there. But by Sunday, I was over it and ready to dig in and take a look at everybody's photos and stuff. Because I always, you know, in the past, I've always enjoyed whenever friends go to cons looking at all their photos and stuff.
Yeah.
But, and you just never know what people are going to come up with.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one of the craziest I saw was, it wasn't really like a friend's photo. It was just a photo on a page that I follow. But, it was a dude dressed up as like a space marine from that Gears of War video game series.
Yeah.
But all of his armor and weaponry and stuff like that was Hello Kitty themed.
Oh, wow.
So he was like a Hello Kitty space marine. It was pretty bizarre.
Yeah, there's some weird ideas. There's some unique ideas. There's some crappy costumes, too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's inevitable, I guess. But we're back, and hopefully we're going to have a string here of regularly released episodes.
Yes, I got to start reading the older stuff. I did pick up some old stuff. I picked up a treasury-sized Howard the Duck with the Defenders in the background. I picked up the treasury-sized Bible that you always see the ads of in the 70s the 70s comics. And then I picked up...
Yeah.
What else did I pick up? Oh, Tarzan. I picked up some treasury-sized Tarzan. I think the only two that exist... So
those were purchases at the con or just
at the con? Yeah.
Cool. Was there any, anything you saw or any, exhibits or anything like that, that kind of relevant to, the Retrocast or?
No, there's obviously a lot of old comics, but I didn't buy a lot. For one thing, I don't like to lug around a lot of stuff anymore. I used to like go to the UPS store and ship a box back, and that's just too much. So whatever could fit into my suitcase usually is what I get.
Yeah.
And I had went on that buying splurge with the Marvel Monsters like before the con, so I was like, yeah, I don't know if I want to spend too much on old comics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and honestly, I mean, nowadays... When you're hunting, I mean, if you're going to find anything into the con, it's going to be because, you know, that it's a good deal. It's not necessarily something you couldn't find elsewhere, but it's the price that you can find it at. But some of the sketches you got, though, were, you've been kind of on a kick of getting...
Oh, they are kind of retro sketches. I got a Lady Blackhawk, a Phantom Lady... And I got a Beautiful Dreamer and Big Bear. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I got some retro characters.
Yeah, that's cool. That's something I've kind of learned from you and Keith and other guys that are used to going to the cons and stuff is sort of thinking outside the box in terms of what sketch you're asking for and from whom, you know?
Yeah.
Like asking for, even if the character's not obscure, maybe the person that you're asking isn't known for drawing that character, you know?
Yeah.
And I think sometimes you can really get some, sketches that have that extra, just that extra wow factor to them because the artist is excited to draw it, you know?
Yeah. Like, Keith picked Don Quixote, and how many people are going to want that?
Yeah, that's
true. But George Perez was so happy because he actually was going to play Don Quixote in a play, and he started singing the lyrics of whatever Don Quixote sings in the play while he was drawing the sketch.
That's awesome.
Like, Keith was making people happy. And then Garcia Lopez loves Don Quixote, so in a previous con, he drew Don Quixote, and then he drew, I can't pronounce the heavy guy's name, Sancho Panza or whatever. I don't know.
That was close. I think it, yeah, Sancho Panza.
Yeah. I'm getting better as I know Keith. He'll get somebody to sketch the human condition.
Yeah. Keith is educating you on all kinds of things you'd never know.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. George Perez seems like a great guy to meet. He seems like he's a lot of fun.
Yeah, he seems like he's there because he wants to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Not all artists are like that.
Yeah, that Lady Blackhawk sketch you got, that was Andrew Peepoy, right?
Oh, yeah, that was brilliant. He had fun with that one. He says, he always asks me, like, what do you want the character to be doing? And I just say, use your imagination. He always comes up with some pretty unique stuff. So,
well, I saw that sketch and I thought, man, either this guy knows Mike really well or they're just on the same wavelength, because it's like, it's totally the like 50s pinup style
pose
that she's in, you know. It was a really good, really cool sketch. I like that one a lot.
Yeah, she's bending over, picking up her hat, and she's got Lady Blackhawk panties, or the symbol of the Blackhawk.
Yeah.
So I have I do a little bit different things. You know, people have their sketch things that they do, and mm-hmm. and my thing is I usually find artists that I like, and then just stick with the artist, and then just grow my portfolio. Like, I have a long Scioli, which kind of mimics a Kirby style. And I have quite a few. I'm already in the double digits of Scioli sketches. And then I have Peepoy, who I've had five. I've been to three cons, saw him at three, and every one he's done a sketch for me. And he's pretty like tight with his sketches, because he's usually doing like comics during the con and stuff. He's there to sell his property, like his web comic and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't do too many sketches, but he always like gets me in somehow. Cause he was like inking Futurama while he was at this con, cause he had pages due. And, I really want, but if I couldn't get a sketch from him, I was going to get, like, he's got in his portfolio some Phantom Stranger pages. And you know, that's like my favorite book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the Gene Ha. Like, he actually inked over Gene Ha pages.
Mm.
So, I would start working on those if I could. They're a little more expensive, but...
Yeah, no, but that's awesome. And then you eventually, I mean, you build a collection, and you also build a rapport with the artist. You know, they know, you know, you appreciate it, and you're someone also that will... promote the artist, you know. You know, you're not just taking the sketch home and you know, locking it up. You know, you're gonna post pictures of it and you know, give the artist recognition and stuff. Yeah. So
I would love to have like a Andrew Peepoy Freedom Fighters, like the entire team. It's just that for him to render the entire team would take forever.
Yeah.
But God, I would love to have that, you know. Uncle Sam, the Ray, Dollman, the Human Bomb, who's like one of my favorite characters ever. Like, I've always been fascinated. Like, one of the first comics I picked up off the spinner rack was a Wonder Woman issue. That hence my Wonder Woman. That's why I'm so into Wonder Woman, but it was a cover of Wonder Woman and had the Freedom Fight. It was either a cover of Wonder Woman and had the Freedom Fighters, there's a cover of Freedom Fighters that had Wonder Woman on it. And ever since then, I like became fascinated with the Freedom Fighters. You know, it's kind of like first love at first sight, love at first sight. Like, you just have fond memories of things when you're a kid, and no matter what happens over time, those characters mm-hmm. are embedded in your brain, because they, as soon as you see them, it sparks a flame in your head, and you're like, I remember that, I remember it. And the Human Bomb, I've always been fascinated. He's got like a lame costume where it's like just like a Intel spacesuit with the visor. And they've changed it over the years. They've made it a black one and stuff. But my favorite is the white one. And I used to always be fascinated because he would just take off his glove and just blow shit up. I was like, that was awesome. As a kid, I was like, wow, that guy has to be in the suit all the time. Start a nuclear war. And I remember reading one of the, I guess, the one of the Geoff Johns events a long time ago, or maybe it was Grant Morrison. I don't remember. But there's a scene with the human bomb where he, like, flicks off one of his fingernails and blows up a good portion of, of the city. So, yeah, I like the human bomb. And then Phantom Lady, I've always liked. Her costume's amazing, and she's always been sexy, and I like that little wristband where she used to, you know, put the black power so nobody could see what was going on and kick people's ass. Now she's more organic, I think, in the New 52. They made a lot of the characters organic now instead of where before it was more technology.
That's interesting.
All the rogues are that way now. Before,
yeah.
And I really had a hard time getting into them because the rogues are some of my favorite, like, of all time. But it's starting to kind of win me over slowly but surely.
Yeah. Well, I guess with the Freedom Fighters, I mean, you could always approach it, you know, get a large enough paper, you know, and you know, just have them do one character at a time and keep bringing it back. Do it like a one-man jam piece, you know?
Yeah, the only risk in that is him not being at the cons that I go to.
Right. Could take even longer that way.
Take forever.
Yeah. Well, it would be a cool jam piece even if you had a few different artists work on it. A Freedom Fighters scene, that'd be pretty neat. Pretty unique. I wouldn't, you know, there can't be that many Freedom Fighters jam pieces out there.
Yeah, that'd be a fun one to have.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I didn't do any shopping at the con because I wasn't there, but I did pick up something recently that's relevant to the show. I had built up some credit over time by trading in stuff to mycomicshop.com, and I decided, so I think it was a couple years ago, DC put out this huge book called 75 Years of DC Comics. And you know, I looked at it in the store. It was just kind of—it's just such a massive volume.
Coffee table book.
Yeah, I mean, even.
And I think it makes its own coffee table.
yeah, a coffee table book in that it is a coffee table in itself. Yeah, I mean, just because the dimensions of it, not so much on the page count, but just the size of it. Naturally, it was kind of expensive, but. They recently, though, have started to break that down, and they're issuing a 5-volume set over time that expands on that. And so each individual volume is 400 pages, but the actual dimensions of the book are a little bit more manageable and easier to hold in your hands. And the first two, so with that credit, I picked up the first one, waited till I had it in hand just to, you know, make sure that I really liked them. And once I did, I went ahead and put my order in for this second volume. And those are the only two that are out so far. So they break it down. Naturally, it goes Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age will be the next one that comes out in the spring. And then the last two they've decided to call the Dark Age and the Modern Age. So if I have any criticism so far, it's just that those aren't the greatest names, in my opinion, the Dark Age and the Modern Age. I don't know if those were the best choices, but the Dark Age looks like will basically cover, you know, the 80s maybe the 90s. I'm not sure the exact cutoff it will be. But each of them, you know, have a article or an essay, rather, by Paul Levitz, and then each of them have a different interview, a new interview. The Golden Age, this has an interview with Joe Kubert, and then the Silver Age has Neil Adams, and then the upcoming ones will, for the Bronze Age, will have Denny O'Neill. Dark Age will have with Jeanette Kahn, and then finally Modern Age will be an interview with Jim Lee. So, you know, these are by Taschen Publishing, just like the large 75-year volume, and lots of really great images, lots of really great, you know, panels and covers and other, like, outside of just comics, like newspaper ads from the time and sketches and, like, toys and things like that. Just kind of, as you go through the book, just kind of building a picture of that period and time, not just in the comics, but in outside the comics as well, like the like some stuff on the, like, this Golden Age volume has some stuff from the Fleischer Studios Superman cartoon and things like that. So also incorporates, like, you know, Fawcett stuff, Captain Marvel, things that, you know, later got purchased and folded into DC. So looking forward to digging into these. This Golden Age cover is from 1935 to 1956. Got a really cool dust jacket with Golden Age Batman on the front and Golden Age Superman on the back, and the spine has oval, little ovals with portraits of Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, Flash, Robin, Plastic Man, and Hawkman. And when you line up the Silver Age volume next to it, they go in, the portraits go in the same order, but, you know, represent the Silver Age look of those characters. Or in the case of Green Lantern and the Flash, you have you know, you have Barry Allen and Hal Jordan instead. And the last two, Plastic Man and Hawkman, on the Silver Age volume are replaced with Sergeant Rock and Adam Strange. So it seems like those last two, like, sort of represent characters just specifically from that era. So you know, as a fan of history and comic book history, these are really exciting to have. And I'll probably, as time goes on, just pick out tidbits here and there, little facts that I learned from going through the books and mention them on the show. So make sort of a little feature out of it.
Yeah, I have it, but that book is hard to read. It's huge.
Yeah.
It weighs a ton, man. It's beautiful, but...
You have the 75.
Yeah, the whole the huge book. It's about 2 feet tall. I mean, yeah, laying on its side, maybe 3 feet if you lay it on the other side. It's like 2 feet by 3 feet or something.
Yeah, and I don't have, so I don't have that, but I'm going to collect these individual volumes. These are a little bit easier to hold in your lap. I'd say it's probably like maybe like, I wonder what the actual dimensions of it are, but it's definitely more of like a manageable size book to hold.
Yeah, more of a reader's copy than a collector's copy.
Yeah, so yeah, pretty cool. I'm pretty happy with them so far.
Cool deal.
Yeah.
So what do you want to jump into first, Random Comics or Kirby?
Well, we could go either way. It's been a while. Either way, we gotta sort of. I had to sort of catch up and remind myself of where we were at with the Fourth World stuff.
Yeah. Well, I knew we were ending. Let's go ahead and do the Kirby stuff then.
Sounds good.
I knew we were ending two titles, which is sad.
Yeah.
But we're ending Forever People and New Gods.
Yeah, it was interesting to read both of those and as last issues and stuff, and then to read Mr. Miracle 11, you know, which that series did continue for a little bit longer. And so obviously it's just more of like a regular issue.
I thought forever people had at least were walking off into the sunset type thing and an ending, whereas New Gods kind of like, wham, it just ended.
Yeah.
It was weird. It was very weird because it didn't even, like, at least on the Forever People, it kind of said, you know, like, hey, we're going away for a while and here's, check out the demon. Whereas mm-hmm. the New Gods one just walked off into the sunset with a lot of untold stuff, I thought.
Yeah, and I wonder if, you know, I wonder if Kirby at the time really had a, had any sense that he would maybe, because we know now that he came back and did some more later on, which is also in this volume four. But I wonder if at the time he, you know, just there was just too much with the Forever People. The plot was a little bit simpler. He could resolve it, but there was just too much to wrap up in one issue. So he kind of left it unfinished to either, you know, have somebody else take it up or finish it himself, and kind of in some ways both things happened.
Mm-hmm. So this Forever People, which I got a cool, beautiful dreamer sketch from Dean Stahl. I liked it because it looked like she was go-go dancing. But
yeah, that was a nice sketch too.
And he's like got this outfit too. She's got the pink outfit. Which I think she wears all the time. At least in most of the times you see her. But on this cover, it says that the Forever People are being hunted down from the pursuer. And this pursuer has a name. And his name is... it's hard to pronounce because you think it would have two L's. But is it Devilance?
That's like, how I would say it, yeah.
Because, like, Devil and then Lance, because he carries around a lance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he's an asshole because he's the one that canceled the book, but blame it on Devil Lance.
That's the devil part of his name.
Yeah.
Him being an asshole. yeah, and we have promised the return of Infinity Man, who we haven't seen for a while. When the Forever People came up against Darkseid earlier on, Darkseid banished Infinity Man.
Yep, that's true. He's been gone for quite some time. And Devil Lance is like hunting the Forever People for Darkseid. And he comes into, is it Trudy Magruder? Is that her name?
I think that's right, yep.
Trudy Magruder, who... The poor soul is going to wonder where her tenants went. Because that's never resolved.
Yeah, that's true. They're never going to come back.
But he comes in with his lance. It's weird because when he fires his lance, it looks like a true lance. Like a lance that you would joust with or something. Mm-hmm. Like even on the cover. But later on when they show it, it has like a blade at the end of it. So I don't know if it just like extends out and can change shape. But this guy is like a hunter. He's like a manhunter. He's going to find out whoever he's tracking and bring them in, and that's what his goal is here. Is he shows up at Trudy's rented apartment that the Forever People are staying at and starts firing his blaster, which causes a stir with the police. And they give Trudy some shit. Like, why can't you rent to normal people? Why do you have to rent to these space hippies?
Yeah, I like that. You and your weirdo borders have done it again. But, yeah, I really like how, you know, Devil Lance is a real unstoppable force here. I think throughout the issue, that's something that comes across, is that no matter what the Forever People do, every time they think that maybe they've put him down or just tricked him enough to escape, he shows up again. There's just no it's like early appearances of the Juggernaut and the X-Men. You know, it's just there's just no way to stop them, and there's no way to get away.
Yeah. The cops do seem to chase him off, though.
Yeah, and I at first I was a little surprised by how quickly he runs off, but I guess Kirby was cognizant of that because he has the thought bubble as he flies away that he has instructions to avoid Earthmen. So
yeah, he can't affect them.
Just in case we might think for a second that he's afraid of the cops, you know. But the reason he takes off is because the Forever People disappear using, I think, the Mother Box, right?
Yeah, they're basically able to phase out and arrive somewhere, and it took them to this like cave-like substance, and then you get flashbacks with the Infinity Man, who's like in this weird universe where he's trying to escape. It's almost like he's in some kind of dome, like the TV show Under the Dome, and he can't break that barrier no matter how hard he tries. He tries and tries again, and this time it weakens him enough that he has to land on this strange planet that looks like it's got a lot of flowers and stuff. Like, if you're a vegan, you'd probably want to be on this planet. there doesn't seem to be any organic life. It just seems like plant life. I mean, well, organic life, but it seems like there's a lot of plant life, but there's no animals anywhere or creatures. It's just plants.
Yeah, it doesn't look too habited, yeah, in general. Pretty, like, there's no buildings or anything like that. But, yeah, this trap of sorts that he's in is interesting because it seems like as long as he's not trying to escape, he can just fly and fly and explore and keep going and going. But as soon as he actually tries to attempt to escape this particular universe, you know, he smashes against an invisible wall. So sort of has weird physical properties of the trap. But that's basically, you know, we finally get to see where he ended up and where he's been all this time. And, you know, when we fly back to the Forever People, you know, once again, their escape didn't really buy them much time. Devil Lance catches up with them surprisingly fast. So they decide to actually confront him, and Moon Rider fires his Megaton Touch at him without really much of an effect. But they do get him to sink down to molten lava. And this is the first of many times where they think, or at least are hoping, that they've stopped him. You know, they kind of, Beautiful Dreamer tricked him. So they walk into the lava by making him think that there was a solid floor there. But, like I said earlier, it doesn't really do much to stop him. I mean, it gives them, buys Forever People a couple minutes to use the Mother Box again. But, you know, as soon as they do, Devil Lance is escaping and getting ready to pursue them again.
And they ping themselves to a remote island near the Pacific Ocean. And Devil Lance finds them pretty quick. And Moon Rider does get in a good shot into the face.
Yeah.
And then Big Bear, they all start to attack him. But that doesn't seem to do good once he gets his lance. What they try to do is they try to take away the lance originally.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they kick his ass, at least initially. It's like they're able to like use this magna waves and take the lance away, and that's when everybody attacks him and starts beating the crap out of him. But his lance is like Thor's hammer. He can summon it. So he summons the lance again and then starts taking over. But Seraphim quickly grabs a cartridge and kind of like is it a gravity energy cartridge, and it kind of like freezes him, and then he just sinks into the ground because he weighs so much.
Yeah.
They could probably do something to him, but I guess they're a peaceful, loving gods. They don't want to kill him because when he's this like huge cement gravity thing, or when he was in the molten lava, seems like you could just cut him up into pieces and get away. But they choose to run instead.
Yeah, I guess they're mostly just trying to trap him. Big Bear asks Seraphin, you know, after he does that to him, if it'll hold him, and he just, you know, says he hopes so, but they don't really know. They're not really familiar with Devil Lance enough to know how powerful he is. So they just sort of, you know, trek off into the jungles of the island. You know, but and I think, like I said, where this is where it really at this point, it seems kind of, there's this ominous feeling. I honestly, because this was the last issue, as I was reading it, I really, it conveyed to me the danger of their situation. I honestly didn't know if they would, what their final fate would be, whether they would escape or not. You know, which is a kind of hard to come by sometimes in comics. You know, you always expect a happy ending, but we see that Devil Lance is approaching once again, but we flip over to Infinity Man again, who has been just resting on this planet, and once he's got enough energy to fly up again out of orbit, you know, he realizes that if he's ever going to get out of there, he needs to reconnect with the Forever People, and he has to somehow get them to attempt to summon him again, or communicate somehow through the Mother Box that that they should try once more to summon him.
Using the magic words of Taru.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and it's like a last-minute standstill, too, because, you know, it's like kind of a last desperate act because they're cornered by Devil Lance again.
Yeah, they've escaped three times so far, and this time doesn't look promising, but looks like it's the final standoff because Devil Lance tracks him after the gravity cartridge runs out. Mm-hmm. And they summon Infinity Man, and it kind of looks like Infinity Man's gonna kick his ass. Like, when I was reading this, I've never read this issue before. Like, I've read almost every one of these issues. I never read the final issue of the Forever People, so I didn't know what was gonna happen. So I kind of thought, well, wow, they could go a couple ways with this. And it kind of ends up in a huge explosion, like they're evilly matched. And then you just hear boom on this island, and this massive fire that's kind of like burning the entire island. And then it cuts to a Desaad and Darkseid in the background, kind of saying that, what were they talking about? I forgot.
Well, they're you know, observing from afar through their technology, the explosion, and, you know, the implication of their conversation is that, you know, no one can really ever take away Devil Lance's weapon. So it's almost like the meeting of Devil Lance and Infinity Man was like a unstoppable, what do they say, like an unstoppable force meets a immovable object or something.
Yeah.
And the resulting explosion is just, it took Devil Lance and Infinity Man with it. And, you know, the Forever People are now in a place where they may stay forever.
Right, because they're in the same, it looks like they're in the same place where he was. You know, like in that planet that he was.
Mm-hmm.
Before they said Taru, it looks like they're on that same planet, and there's no life there but plants. So,
yeah, at least to what we've seen so far. Although there is in the final frame, there is like a butterfly-looking creature in the foreground. So there may be a lot more to the planet we haven't seen. But basically, Infinity Man is gone. So. They're kind of trapped there, but they're honestly, they're not. I mean, it's kind of a happy ending in the sense that they're really not fazed by it. They're, if anything, just excited about exploring the planet and accepting of their destiny. So they're, you know, hippies to the end. I guess Kirby kind of gives them the happy ending of, you know, they're stuck on this planet, but they're stuck on a peaceful planet, and they're peaceful, and, you know, through these 11 issues, we've kind of followed them, just kind of wanting to sort of do their thing and have fun, and they've been met with a lot of conflict and battle and stuff like that, so he kind of puts them in a place where they'll be at peace. So, and like you said, there's a little ad for the demon. So it's like, you know, this series is ending, but go buy this other series by Kirby from DC.
Yeah. That leads us to New Gods number 11, which has Kalibak and Orion battling it out. And this is the first time I've seen Kalibak look like Blastar, like he's got power emitting from his hands.
Oh, yeah.
And you have Black Racer in the background, so there's some foreshadowing that maybe somebody's not going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
But they have the police. I think this scene is funny, but it's kind of like a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. The police have devised this technology to imprison Kalibak, and it's like this real extravagant thing that takes the power of the whole city to run. So as they're running this thing and holding Kalibak, nobody has lights. Nobody has anything. They're using all their power to hold Kalibak, and they realize that they can't keep doing this. You know, yeah. Like, what do we do? We have this guy. We don't have any technology to, like, send him back home. What the hell do you do? So you open up a cell. We need power back. You know, people are complaining about their TVs not working.
Yeah, I'll mention that the name of this story is Dark Side and Sons, which I think is a really cool title.
Yeah, it's named after Sanford and Son.
Yeah. See, there's another sitcom for you.
Yeah.
There's all these sitcom ideas. I mean, we can have at 8 o'clock, we'll have, you know, Trudy Magruder and her crazy tenants. And then, you know, after that, we'll have Dark Side and Sons.
Those would be good shows. Especially, you could use, like, the John Byrne script that he did with the Big Barda and Superman. Have you seen, have you heard about that?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
That's pretty messed up.
Yeah. It's just so funny because it could make a sitcom. Because your worst enemy shows up at your house, drinks your wine, sits on your couch, and said, let's watch a video. So I'm going to pop in a video, and it's a video of your wife having sex with somebody else. And Mr. Miracle is like, oh my God. Oberon's even in shock.
So messed up. That's the kind of thing that can only happen in comics because of the nature of these, you know, properties that are owned by a company, that someone could create these characters and then, like, decades later someone could come along and write a story like that about them.
It was terrifying, though. That's like a horror. I mean, that just shows how much Darkseid hates those people.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And if you want to read those issues, they're Action Comics 592 and 593. You can find them on Comixology.
Yeah.
Art is amazing. God, I would kill for one of those pages of Big Barda. Oh, God.
Yeah, I do like his style, for sure.
He was at the top of his game when he was doing Superman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was like his best art to me. It was even better than his Fantastic Four.
Mm. Yeah, I think the first John Byrne art I ever saw was on Uncanny X-Men, which, you know, I didn't read when it came out, but later on, I think that's how I discovered his stuff. Maybe. So, I mean, he was still working for Marvel when I started reading comics, so I might have saw something current from him in the 80s first. I don't know. But that was one of the first times, I think, those early Claremont issues that he drew, that just where he just really, you know, blew my mind with the Hulk Flyer Club scenes. And, as a young man, seeing Jean Grey walk around as the Black Queen and Emma Frost as the White Queen was quite impressionable upon me.
I'll be right back.
Still impressionable on you, I guess. But, yeah, basically they decide to let Kalibak go because, like you said, they don't really have much more of a choice. And
he is one of the ugliest creatures on the planet, I think. Kalibak is ugly, man. He is damn ugly.
And it's kind of scary. Like, they let him go. He gives his word that, that he's going to carry the word to the forces of Apocalypse and New Genesis, that, you know, Earth doesn't want anything to do with their fight, and they want him to, you know, to either settle things peacefully or take it elsewhere, basically. And Commissioner Kiernan offers his office as a place for them to meet and, you know, have their summit. And you turn the page, and Kalibak's, you know, smashes the bonds that they have him in and is just laughing at the top of his lungs. And they're all flinching because they're thinking, like, what's this guy going to do? He's going to, you know, is he going to kill us right away? But he's just cracking up at the idea of New Genesis and Apocalypse settling their dispute in a city police commissioner's office. But he just takes off through the wall, smashes his way through the nearest wall, and I like how the uniformed cops nearby just immediately start shooting at him as he leaves. It's like, hold your fire. It's not going to do anything anyways.
Yeah, you're wasting your bullets.
Yeah.
And that takes us to the apartment that Orion and Light Ray are staying at. And they know that Orion... Well, no, at this time they don't know where... They know that... Do they know that Kalibak is in custody? I don't know.
I don't know if they know that he's in custody. They know that he's there somewhere.
Yeah, they know that there's going to be a final showdown, and he grabs Orion's frustrated because he wants to just kick ass, and Light Ray's like his conscious, like, let's be patient. You know what happens when you rush off and do stuff without thinking about it, and Orion decides to take this. Is it Lincoln's trophy? Mm-hmm. Lincoln worked hard for this trophy, whatever it is, a trophy of. It's hard to tell. But it's like some kind of sports trophy that he worked hard in his college years to get. And Orion decides to pick it up during his frustration and just smash the damn thing. Just like destroy it.
he snaps it in half. Poor Dave Lincoln. I mean, the next scene, Light Ray and Orion are talking, and Dave Lincoln's just crouched in the background holding a piece of it like, damn. I just have to imagine, like, so Dave Lincoln's been one of the original people that Orion freed from Darkseid way back in the beginning of the series. It's like, you just have to imagine what his life was like after all of this. Like, how do you, after the forces of New Genesis and Apocalypse leave the Earth, like, how do you go back to work the next day and just
start your life
sit
over.
At your sit at your desk and just do your day-to-day life? Like, it'd be interesting to see, you know, a follow-up where, you know, Dave Lincoln's just like an alcoholic and homeless or something because he could never adjust back to society or something, because he's just like, his mind is just blown.
He's sitting there walking like the Jerk, like Steve Martin in The Jerk, is like, all I need is this broken trophy.
All I need is this book and this trophy.
And this chair.
And this chair that I just found and this bag of trash. And all I need is this stray dog that I just came across.
And Claudia Shane, she's also one of them, runs in and then says, Kalibak has escaped from jail. And they know that this is going to be the final battle, and Light Ray's kind of like, let's just sit calmly and wait for him. And Orion doesn't want to wait. He wants to go out there, which would probably have been a better thing because the strategy of Light Ray's didn't work out too well. But Desaad and Darkseid have some interesting conversation here about the two different mothers of Orion and Kalibak, which I thought was pretty fascinating. The one thing I found that was fascinating out of this is that Sui was betrayed by Desaad, and she's the reason she's gone. So
we find out that Desaad didn't know actually that Sui was Kalibak's mother, but Tigra was chosen for Desaad, and he defied his mother's wishes and courted Sui and had a child with her. Darkseid blasts Desaad with his Omega Blast, and he said, so it says that's to remind you that I know that you were the one who killed Sui. So Desaad killed, at the Queen's command, killed Sui because Darkseid went after, wanted to be with her instead of who was chosen for him.
Yeah. It's kind of like that show, Sister Wives or whatever. He has a lot of wives.
It's very... it's interesting how it's very courtly drama, like kings, queens, betrothals and secret poisonings and stuff. It's like Apocalypse, Game of Thrones kind of.
Yeah.
And very interesting.
Yeah, that was I guess his Omega beams too have different modes of firing, because usually when you get hit by them, you're transported somewhere, right? In this case, it just kind of blasted him.
Yeah, it seems he can control the how powerful it is too. When Cyclops has good control over his eye blast, he can make him stronger or not. Seems like he can set it to stun, so to speak, rather than kill. He turns a little knob on the side of his blue helmet.
So Kalibak knows exactly where they're at, because he goes exactly to the building and starts smashing the building. Dave Lincoln and them are like, and Orion and Light Ray are like falling all over the place because the building's coming apart. And
that's one way to get their attention. Just walk up and punch the building.
Light Ray says, let me take care of this. So he goes out there and he blasts him with the Nova Burst. And it looks like it did something for like maybe a nanosecond. But Kalibak is like in Kirby Crackle, like all over the place. He's smoldering. It might have burned some hair off of his shoulders. But he comes back out and like, yeah, do anything. You're like a novice in battle. And he just spanks him, beats the crap out of him. Orion is there with Lincoln and the girl just looking at Light Ray, just getting his ass whooped. I mean, pulverized. And they're like, oh, combat code. I can't interfere. His best buddy is going to get killed. I thought that was hilarious.
It's pretty rough. I mean, because the panel beforehand, he's just pounding him off panel.
He's beating the shit out of Light Ray.
I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, I could see that he was dead after this beating. And the only thing that kind of, thankfully they've established this whole combat code thing before. We have seen it in a previous episode where, you know, if there's a one-on-one battle, you know, you're not supposed to interfere until it's over. So at least we have seen that before, because otherwise this would just seem like completely like out of nowhere and heartless, or just a like convenient plot device to just, you know, destroy Light Ray. But we have at least seen that before.
Well, I would have even told, I would have said something to Lincoln. Is there anything you can do? Because I can't interrupt right now.
Yeah, really.
Lincoln, can you go fire a shot at his head, see if you could distract him, or go get a tractor and try to run over him? Do something, because he's going to kill my buddy. But instead, they're just looking in shock. And the scene cuts to Willie Walker, who's still in his coma. Mm-hmm. And his sister is trying to take care of him. And he awakens. So he's being summoned for somebody's death. And at this point, I thought it might be Light Ray.
Yeah.
Because I was like, well, How's that gonna, you know, stop? He's just like, Light Ray is unconscious, and he's just like bam, 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 bam.
Yeah, and I think it's based for, you know, specifically to maybe get you to think that that's a possibility, really, you know, the way that the scene comes right after. I did like that, you know, as you said, Willie's being taken care of by his sister, and his sister's, I guess it's her husband. I like that he said, you know, what he says, that in response to Willie's sister wondering, you know, are we doing the best for him? You know, this is, it's putting a toll on our marriage to have to take care of him and everything like that. And her husband says, you know, it's worth it, you know, because, you know, Willie fought in Vietnam and suffered there. So, you know, we can handle the problems it causes for us to take care of him. So, but that was just like a nice little character beat there that wasn't necessary, you know?
Yeah. Very serious moment, very supporting husband, because he could easily say, yeah, it is taking a burden on our marriage. Let's go.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, he awakens as the Black Racer and takes off, and we switch back to the beginning of the battle between Darkseid's sons, Orion and Kalibak. And you know, at this point, it's interesting that Orion too, you know, the the secret is out. You know, there's no more hiding who he is, and I think. Does Kalibak know that he's, I think Orion's the one that's more willing to admit that, that he's Darkseid's son, or is more aware of it almost.
Yeah, because I don't remember the exact panel, but there's something that Kalibak says that makes you think that he doesn't even know, you know? Like,
yeah.
He's not my father.
But, I think probably one of my favorite, moments here is, you know, the next scene with Darkseid and Desaad. And, I mean, as you said earlier, we don't have a full resolution in this issue of everything, because there's just so much, such a big plot going on. But this definitely is a strong, strong finishing moment here, at least partially, where we have a continuation of that earlier scene between the two of them. And, you know, all along there's been this kind of tenuous relationship between Darkseid and Desaad. You get the sense at times that Darkseid knows that Desaad is pretty nuts and is pretty cruel, but he uses him for his own purposes. And as you read the scene, you kind of realize that at some point Darkseid was going to get tired of Desaad and his insanity, you know, and that's exactly what happens.
Well, I think what Darkseid wanted was for they're his flesh and blood, right? They're his sons. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He wanted them to fight, but he didn't want anybody interfering in the battle.
Mm-hmm.
And in the battle, you see things that we haven't seen before, like Kalibak seems much stronger, and he seems to have these blast powers that come out of his hands. And before that scene, he almost renders Orion like he's just kicking the crap out of him. Mm-hmm. He's beating him in every facet. Orion's like devastated, laying on the ground, and he drops a whole building on top of him.
Mm-hmm.
And you're wondering, well, why is this battle like a little more equal? Well, the Saad was using this device to absorb energy and feed it back into Kalibak.
Mm-hmm.
And so he strengthened Kalibak, and that's when Darkseid just, I've tolerated you and your twisted mind too long. This time you've turned it against my own kin. Now, you know, it's like, you've done it now. You've done it this time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah. Like, yeah, basically, Orion is his son, so it's not that he's become super mushy all of a sudden, but the two of them are his sons, and if one is going to kill the other, it's going to be because he did it on his own. You know, it's not going to be because he doesn't want to see Orion go down because he was tricked and, you know, not given a fair fight. So it's too much for him, and man, does he... You know, he doesn't even give Desaad a chance to scream. He just, the Omega Beams strike, and there's no life, no death, no sign of previous existence. The caption reads, you know, Desaad is just winked out of existence, and Darkseid has a nice parting line here. This is what you are now, a small fading patch of light, soon to vanish from sight. Farewell to Saad. So he doesn't just kill him, he winks him out of existence, basically. So yeah. Rather violent end to that partnership.
There was one scene too that I thought was hilarious. You have Lincoln and that cop in the car. They're heading back to the battle scene. And that one cop has like a CB, but I guess he doesn't want anybody else to hear because he's got headsets on. So he's like, he's talking over the control to like radio instructions to everybody, but he's got these headsets on, and he says all sorts of weird things are happening. There was even a report of a black man flying on skis headed in this direction. That was funny.
Poor guys, they have no idea what the hell's going on.
God, flying on skis, what? What the hell's happening? Why is there a guy on skis? It just sounds outrageous.
It is. So yeah, once we get back to the battle, Kalibak no longer has the powers that Desaad was giving him, so you know, he's surprised to suddenly realize that, and also realize that Orion didn't die and has escaped from the rubble of the building. So now they're one on one without any trickery behind the scenes, and this is when, you know, the Black Racer flies in the background, so we know something is about to go down. And Orion, you know, typical, the hero's beat down and close to death, and then, you know, has the final, you know, the referee is lifting Hulk Hogan's arm up off the mat, and it drops, and then it lifts it up and drops it again, and he lifts it up, and Hulk Hogan's makes a fist and holds his arm up, and the crowds go wild.
It almost makes you think, though, like in one panel, that he might have been blasted by the Black Racer, but he was just in the area of when that happened.
Yeah, Ryan's pounding on Kalibak and some pretty powerful punches and stuff. And it's kind of a neatly framed scene where Orion lifts Kalibak up over his head for the pile driver, I guess, to continue the wrestling shit. So he's holding him up over his head as the Black Racer flies in at him with his and he lifts up his ski pole. I guess that's how he takes the person. And you really can't tell from the way the scene is framed if he's aiming at Orion or Kalibak. And we actually see in the next two panels just Orion screaming, and then the speed lines of the Black Racer flying through and taking someone with him, and then we finally see that it's Orion remaining, and that it was Kalibak that was taken by the Black Racer. And so Orion gets his chance to do his final speech. And as you said, this basically ends, on the cliffhanger, and even so much that, Orion indicates that this isn't the ending, because the ending will actually be, there won't be any ending until Father faces Son, until he comes against Darkseid.
Mm-hmm.
So whether Kirby was, leaving it for somebody else to finish up, or he hoped to, one day finish it as he did, it's hard to say, but I guess either way, he's like realized that there wasn't enough space to finish things,
Yeah, never read The Hunger Gods, so I'm looking forward to that. Hunger Dogs, is that what it is? I can't remember.
Hunger Dogs.
Yeah. Hunger Dogs. I've never read it, so it'll be interesting to see that, because I have read The New Gods. I think it's called The New Gods. It's either that or Orion. Walt Simonson did a series, and in there, him and them have a huge battle scene between Darkseid and Orion. So yeah, I don't know if it happens in the Hunger Dogs as well.
Well, before The Hunger Dogs came out, there was a reprint series of The New Gods, which is, there was first five issues that reprinted what we've just read, 1 through 11. And then it actually contained in the sixth issue, it contained new content. It's about like 40 pages of new content, and that actually precedes the Hunger Dogs. So we have that coming up as well in this book. So that'll be interesting to look forward to. But before we get to that, as we've mentioned, the Mr. Miracle continued for a little while. So we'll have a few episodes where we just cover a few Mr. Miracle issues at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of which, did you read Mr. Miracle 11 as well?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. This is another neat cover where we have Mr. Miracle chained up, falling from the height of a huge pole that Big Barda is at the bottom of, above a flaming pit. And that's kind of how the episode starts, with them setting up and rehearsing this trap. Because if you remember last time, Thaddeus Brown's son showed up to see Oberon. And just at that time, Mr. Miracle, Big Barda, and the Furies showed up, teleported in. And so Ted Brown, he's kind of like a talent agent, and so he's taken them on as his new clients. So they're rehearsing a new trick. And it cracked me up how the Furies, they're just brought right into the act.
Yeah, it's like here they're not. You know how they've escaped from Apocalypse as well. Mm. They're really loyal to Big Barda, so they're really not evil. Whereas a lot of times, they'll be portrayed as Darkseid's warriors or Granny Goodness's warriors. Here they've separated from Granny, and they're just helping with the props and stuff of, because they're filming this for like a TV show, or like a commercial to get people to watch the show, like where it's going to be like an escape artist session every week. Poor Oberon is stuck in this costume that he doesn't want to be in, but he looks like a little Mr. Miracle.
That's pretty funny.
And Big Barda is there in her bikini outfit. She's not in her warrior outfit. She's out being filmed, and he's like, "That's." He's like, she's like lifting this pole. Mr. Miracle's on the pole. This is a huge pole, and she's like putting it into this hole in the ground, and the cameraman, who's Thaddeus Brown's nephew, or is it his son? His son. And he's filming it. He said, "That's fine, Barda, just fine. Nobody would believe this unless I got it on film. What a woman."
I love it how impressed everyone is with Big Barda. It's pretty awesome. But yeah, Kirby's take on the Furies seems to be pretty much they're Barda's women, you know, so whatever she says goes, they follow whatever her loyalty is. And I think when we first see them, it's just the last time they saw Barda, you know, their job was to work for Granny Goodness for Apocalypse. So in the absence of anything further from her, they continue their last assignment, you know?
Yeah.
But once she shows up and says, "All right, here's the deal, you know, this is what's going on, and we're with Mr. Miracle now," they follow along with her, you know.
This double page splash I thought was amazing, because if you look at that perspective, it's like a 3D perspective where you're looking down on them.
Mm-hmm.
That ought to be hard to draw, don't you think? I mean, because it just seems the perspective is just, it's so different.
Yeah, it is a cool camera angle, because you have it's as if you're floating above, and you just above Mr. Miracle on the top of the pole, so that he's in the foreground and in the top right corner, and then you follow your eye down to Barda holding the pole just above the hole in the ground that she's gonna put it into. And, you know, you have everybody arranged around him. It was really cool.
Very neat. I liked it.
So, Bernadeth, sets the, gasoline in the pool below on fire. Lashina, weakens the pole with her lash, and then, Stompina comes along and Stompa and kicks it to really to break the pole in half, so, and send Scott falling towards the pool of gas. So as usually happens, Scott cuts it closer than even the people that are part of the show are prepared for, and they start freaking out and looking for fire extinguishers, anything to put out the flames. And even Barda, for a second, starts to worry. But, of course, Scott's hanging from a nearby branch, having escaped at the last second. And this is when the animates return, those faceless robot-looking creatures that can be imprinted upon with somebody's personality. They're getting somebody ready to be transmitted onto one of them.
I thought it was going to be Darkseid just because of the trunks and the boots.
I did too, in the way that they sort of sat him down. I don't know, for some reason that posture of preparing in that seat.
Yeah, very, very, how would you say it, straight posture?
Mm-hmm. It's kind of how Darkseid's when he's chilling in Dave Lincoln's apartment that one time, just waiting for them to come home.
Yeah.
But no, it turns out to be Dr. Bedlam, the return of Dr. Bedlam, who's come to get back at Mr. Miracle. And as you said, we see Oberon, as you said, he's not too pleased with the showmanship of of Ted Brown and the fact that he has to wear the silly costume and stuff, which is kind of weird because he's always seems to have had to do that. But he freaks out because he's looking in the mirror and all of a sudden his reflection turns into that of a monster as Bedlam is up to his tricks and starts freaking everybody up and making all these creatures and stuff appear in their house.
And he's starting to freak out thinking he's on fire. Like at one scene, he has all the monsters grab his every appendage and like try to pull him apart. And then the other scene, his face is on fire. And that's when Scott enters the room and knows exactly what's happening. This is Dr. Bedlam. He's getting ready to attack. And they try to explain all that to Thaddeus Brown's son. And Bedlam has a new weapon that he's getting ready called the Sarah Skiff. It looks like a UFO type flying saucer. And he's getting ready to put that against Mr. Miracle. Mm-hmm. But as they're discussing Dr. Bedlam in the house, the animates are coming in and they render the son unconscious, and Oberon shows how versatile he is by running underneath the animate and then kicking him in his ass.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And then one of the animates grabs him by the shoulders and is getting ready to smash Oberon. Whereas then you see the animate just shatter, pow, and Big Barda just blasted it with one punch, and it was
shatters
out.
Into thousands of pieces. Yeah. I also like before that Ted Brown standing there, you know, and as far as he knows, Scott Free is just an escape artist, and he's got some friends who, dress pretty funky. I don't know what he makes of how strong Barda is, but he doesn't really know the real story about what's going on. And the animates come in the window behind him, and all he gets a chance to turn around and be like, what the hell, before he gets just cold cocked by one of them and knocked out.
Yeah.
It's kind of amusing. But the Furies join the fray. There's a lot of these animates to take on. They're obviously they're after Mr. Miracle in particular, and we find out they have a particular objective to take out the mother box that Mr. Miracle keeps hidden in his arm, and they damage that, and that of course is what Scott uses a lot to escape from traps and also overpower Dr. Bedlam and other foes of his that try to take him out. But he and Barda have an exchange, even though he's lost that power, he's got a score to settle with Bedlam, and he insists on going off on his own to he knows that he's walking into a trap, but he goes willingly up to that, what did you say that was called again? The,
Sarah Skiff.
Yeah. Sarah Skiff. The spaceship looking thing.
And, Bedlam's in there waiting for him, and he takes him out with one punch, and it turns out to be an animate. And as soon as that animate goes away, the spaceship leaves the ground and then is smashed by a bunch of rocks as it heads up into space. I guess asteroids. And it's getting smashed. And then, are they going to send it into the sun? I can't remember. Oh no, he's gonna bring it back. He sends it up into space, hits a bunch of rocks, and then it's in the atmosphere, and then he's gonna have it burn up as it comes back down to Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And then it vectors back into space to crash into the moon. So he's going like from extreme temperatures of heat to extreme temperatures of cold because he's going to hit the dark side of the moon. And then Bedlam shows back up in the spaceship like when they're going to crash into the moon and does his victory speech. But Mr. Miracle somehow uses an electro web to trap him while the Sarah skiff is going to crash into the moon. And when it crashes in the moon, everybody on Earth is like, wow, what happened? And Mr. Yeah. Miracle just pops back up and he's back at Thaddeus Brown's house. And he explains how he had some of the mother box integrated into not just his shoulder, but into his face mask.
I love that, you know, when there's this burst of light from the moon, the people in the crowd, they're not like, oh shit, we're gonna die. Someone says, look at the moon, it's shooting off a fireworks display.
And he says, the greatest show off Earth.
Yeah. It couldn't have been anything bad. It was inspiring. It was too beautiful to be the end of the world. But I mean, after the last two issues, of course, I mean, Mr. Miracle has been our favorite quite often throughout this series. But you know, the other two episodes or the other two issues obviously were very you know, very monumental in terms of their plot. And because Mr. Miracle wasn't canceled, this is just, you know, another installment. And and the whole it's pretty typical, I guess, for Mr. Miracle, there'll be some kind of reveal. That's sort of how it tends to be paced, that there's some sort of reveal at the end as to how Mr. Miracle escaped. But the fact that he kind of, you know, there's no indication ahead of time that he also has the mother box in his hood seemed a little like, oh, okay. Like, all right, I guess that makes sense. But entertaining, you know, entertaining issue. But it had a hard competition when you're bringing to the end these long plots and the other issues.
Yeah, if I had to pick my favorite, I'd say it was the New Gods, and it was mostly because of that exchange between Darkseid and Desaad. I thought that was really, really good, and yeah. And the backstory about the mothers, you know, his two wives, and I also liked that combat scene, the battle scene, how he just like let Light Ray just get pummeled. And he couldn't like break that bond or the combat bond, so they just let him get pummeled.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm on the same page as you. That was pretty much my favorite overall. This time around. Just really great. I mean, that relationship all this time between Darkseid and Desaad has been pretty tenuous and very interesting relationship all along, so to have that resolution kind of makes up for the fact that especially if you're reading this at the time that the story doesn't actually come to a full end. I mean, if you were really into this, you'd be, you know, chomping at the bit to see that showdown between Orion and Darkseid, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was pretty satisfying to have a resolution with that with Darkseid and Desaad.
And then I probably like the Forever People second, mostly because of psychological, but to, you know, that Devil Lance guy kind of destroying them. Well, not destroying them, but being in an infinite battle forever with the Infinity Man or however that explosion ended up. I would imagine he's still alive because they never really explain like their bond, you know. They say the magic words and it's like Shazam, they can, you know, like turn, but I got the impression from this issue that they're really just changing places. So it's like calling upon, like Infinity Man is cognizant that he's somewhere else, he's doing whatever he's doing. When they say the magic words, they're pulling him out of whatever situation he's in into whatever situation they're in, and they're trading places is what it looks like to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So no,
I think that is kind of how it works. So yeah, I mean, when we're talking about mainstream comics. I never take Dead or Gone as Dead and Gone, but for the purposes of the story, though, as written and drawn by Jack Kirby, I thought he did a really good job of conveying, you know, the how futile it was as the Forever People attempted to escape. And like I said, I mean, I knew it was the last issue, and the Forever People haven't been used as extensively as some of the other fourth world characters like Darkseid have been since the 70s. So I really did get to a point where I thought, you know, this could end with some of them dying, or and for the purposes of that issue, you know, I was caught up in it. It grabbed me that way, you know. So I thought I did a good job. And all along, Forever People has been kind of like a side story, you know, to the main event. And I thought it had a nice resolution.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, those are some good comics. I missed them because I haven't read them in such a long while. It was kind of refreshing. I was so much into Villains Month, and I read so much Villains Month, and then I read, yesterday I spent the whole day catching up on Infinity, so like, I'm all caught up in that event. But this was just refreshing, and I think that's why I enjoy those events, is because I can vector away from them for a while and refresh my memory and then get re-excited about them, so... Mm-hmm. Whereas if I was just reading them over, it kind of gets depressing, especially on the Marvel side. I don't know if you read that stuff, but it's pretty dark. They've made the heroes like really questionable in my opinion, because they've introduced the concept of multiverses and stuff, and
it's just... I've heard things. I think I'm settling into a trade waiter on modern stuff. I think that's kind of where I'm getting to now.
Yeah.
And just as far as collecting, I mean, I'll still have my collection. I'm still going to continue to work on picking up single issues for the stuff that I like to collect. And you know, especially like I like collecting 80s stuff and some other stuff from later on. But... That's starting to seem like that might work better for me. So I'm a little bit. I was reading a lot of like Marvel Now stuff as it got kicked off and got rolling. And I would say that I thought they were doing a pretty good job with most of the stuff that I read. Pretty good quality stories and stuff. But I'm definitely not up to date now at this point with Infinity and all of that stuff.
Yeah, but it's really, really good. It's so different because you had Bendis for so many years doing you know, decompressed storytelling, and then you have Hickman, who's doing something so epic and moving the story so fast.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like we're having two different extremes on the book.
Yeah.
And I'd like a happy medium in the middle somewhere, to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't... likewise, I read... I was reading when Bendis first took over the Avengers and you know, did that sort of change of status quo and everything like that. And, you know, it's always interesting. I mean, I think Hickman puts forth a lot of interesting concepts and ideas and stuff like that. I think because it's what one of the first things I experienced in comics was a real classic Avengers that will always hold a certain amount of appeal to me. The something I think most recently was the most recent time that was really captured was probably when Avengers was relaunched the first time with Kurt Busiek and George Perez. Just that classic superhero team storytelling where you Kurt Busiek is really, really good at it, you know, where you have a main plot and then you have some subplots that eventually become the main plot. And then I've always loved with team books, like when a couple different members get replaced and you brought in something new. And Avengers have always been good in that way for that. When, you know, I always loved the Avengers roll call issues and, you know, see all these different superheroes and which one of them are going to end up on the team. You always have a couple different characters that are, you know, more B-list characters that end up on the team, and seeing them interact with the bigger heroes is always fun. So I'll always have a soft spot for that kind of a approach to it, that classic approach.
Yeah.
But it's good to see the different stuff. It's good to get new takes. And
yeah, it is. It's refreshing. I read a lot of it yesterday, though. Like, not in the monthly form. I read literally about 10 issues of New Avengers, 10 issues of Avengers, and then read Infinity 1 and 2. Mm. And man, is it, especially in New Avengers, it's, shoot, those guys are very questionable. I know they're making decisions, like tough decisions that may or may not be ethical, but they're making realistic decisions. I'd say that. Mm-hmm. But when they take all your heroes and make them that way, you know, all your top tier heroes, it's kind of weird that they're all like that.
Yeah, it sounds almost, I only read, I think, the first couple issues of that New Avengers, but I don't know if it was you that posted it or somebody else, but I saw something to that effect yesterday, and so it was probably you, and it almost sounds as if it's like reading about politicians, you know?
Yeah. It is like, it's strange, but what do you have for miscellaneous stuff?
All right, well, doesn't look like we have any questions. I did put ask see if anyone had any questions on the Facebook page, and 15 people saw the post.
So all I know 15.
15 people, you're out there and you didn't ask a question, but you saw it. it's wild looking at the pages anymore with all this junk that Facebook throws on there.
Yeah.
If I wanted to, I could have paid $30 and boosted the post.
Then it'd show up on the right.
Yeah. No, it would have reached a estimated 3,800 to 7,100 out of our potential audience of 17,000 people. So we have, so Geek Brunch has a potential audience of 17,000 people, just so you know. But yeah, I have a couple things. Let's see, should I talk about a series that I've talked about on the show before, or one that I've never talked about? Which should I start with?
Let's go with the one you've never talked about before.
Alright, yeah, let's make sure we get that in. So I have a new trade in my collection. It is Camelot 3000. Recently came out in trade. I was actually thinking about buying these in individual issues at one point, and then I saw the trades listed, so I just decided to grab that. I remember hearing actually Keith Knutson talk about this on DC Noise, I believe.
Well, that was to have been an early episode when we actually talked about comics.
Yeah, it must have been. Yeah. old school DC Noise.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a maxi series. So it's 12 issues. Originally came out in early to mid 80s, and it's by Mike W. Barr, with art by Brian Boland. Both creators who have some famous work on Batman comics. But I read the first two issues so far. The title does a good idea, because Camelot 3000 does a pretty good job of conveying the basic high concept of the series. takes place in the year 3000 and deals with the return of King Arthur and the Knights of Camelot to that world. So, you know, one of the things about the legend of Arthur is that he'll return when Britain needs him most. So when we open issue one, aliens are attacking England. There's been no peaceable prelude to this situation. The aliens are there to attack, and they are there to just annihilate all life on Earth. And later we get kind of a flashback and just kind of a sense of how this world came to be in the year 3000. You know, that people basically decided, you know, it's not worth exploring space, and we're going to concentrate on the Earth and abandon all research into space travel. So when it comes time, when the aliens do arrive, there's been no communication prior. There's been no there's no forewarning, and the Earth is really not at all prepared. You know, economically, the world is in pretty dire straits. There's just overpopulation problems, and most of the money is in the hand of few, and there's just a massive poverty and everything like that. So we first meet a character named Thomas Prentice, and he's, like a lot of people, he's leaving England and trying to escape to France, who's taken in refugees. But as they're trying to escape, they come upon an alien, and Thomas's parents are killed. He's able to escape and make his way to a historical dig where he and his parents have been working. They were going to stop there to get supplies on their way to France. So he goes into this kind of underground bunker, and we switch, and we meet another character after that called Jules Futrell, and he's in France. He's pretty much the richest man in the world. And our introduction to him is just kind of to touch base and let us know that he's kind of a philanthropist. So he's doing what he can to help people. And giving up some of his own personal dwellings and stuff like that to house refugees. So back to Thomas, he starts, you know, the aliens are pursuing him, so he starts running down these tunnels in this historical dig, that to the point that, you know, he's just kind of blindly going where he can and trying to get away. And he runs face first into an object, turns out to be a grave, which is inscribed with a message to indicate that supposedly this is the burial place of King Arthur. And sure enough, it's King Arthur himself that comes up out of the grave, and he apparently was placed there and laid dormant all this time to heal from the wound that he was given by Mordred. So it's pretty amusing. Like, you know, Mike Barr really gets down, you know, the difference in speech that Arthur has. Just as he escapes his grave, the aliens do catch up with them, and he grabs the sword-like technological device that Thomas has, and uses it to fight off the aliens, and ends up grabbing one of their blasters that shoots fire. And it's just funny to, like, it's just enjoyable to read his speech as he fights them. He says, "Away with that weird torch, away with it, I say, or better, if ye so dearly wish to see it rend flesh, then give it me, and I shall grant thy boon, though not in the manner ye intended."
Do they all talk like that, or is it just him?
It's him.
As soon as he became him, Or what? Or does he always talk like that?
No, I mean, Thomas is still Thomas. He just runs into the grave and it wakes King Arthur up.
Oh, okay.
Out of his slumber. So they're you know, so he's just speak, because the last thing he knew was that, you know, he was put to rest to heal back in, you know, Camelot time period or whatever. So Thomas tags along, Arthur goes out, and they commandeer the spaceship of that the aliens had taken on. And we also meet one other character in North America, a woman named Commander Acton. And we just see that she's trying to help lead the forces, but this kind of futile effort against the aliens over there as well. Meanwhile, you know, Arthur and Thomas head to Stonehenge, which it's explained that, you know, Stonehenge is still there because even though most of the Earth has been covered and converted to apartment buildings and whatnot, they attempted to knock down Stonehenge and all the workers got sick and all their machinery broke and stuff because of the magic there. Arthur is able to free Merlin there from his imprisonment. And Merlin is a really, like, cranky old bastard. He refers to Thomas as Arthur's pet. And just, like, his characterization is pretty amusing because he makes no space for cordiality. He's just, he's just a real rude bastard, so... the next, you know, so they're just kind of like preparing themselves. Merlin, of course, knows pretty much everything that's going on, and he was expecting this whole thing to happen. So he teleports them to Salisbury Down nuclear plant, and basically the place where Excalibur is being held by the Lady in the Lake is underneath this nuclear plant, which is a nice touch. And, they call up the Lady in the Lake, and her hand appears, and she goes to throw Excalibur to Arthur, but it disappears in the air halfway there. And as we close this first issue, we switch over to the United Nations, and they've amusingly voted 912 to nothing to send to censor the aliens. So it's basically this, like, futile effort. They're saying, oh, yeah, we have this unanimous vote that we're not going to cooperate them. Meanwhile, the aliens have shown no signs whatsoever that they have any interest in cooperating anyone, and they're just annihilating, like, all life on Earth. So the reporter that's saying as much points out that the last envoy they sent, the United Nations sent to speak with the aliens, was disintegrated anyways. But as he's speaking live on television, a large stone erupts out of the earth in the middle of the UN boardroom, and Excalibur, as was once long ago, is imprisoned in the stone. So that's pretty much where issue two picks up.
What is the pace of this book? Does it, like, suck you in, or is it a product of its time, or what did you think of it?
I found it pretty easy to get into. It's denser than comics are nowadays. I mean, you could probably tell by everything I just described happens in the first issue. So we're not talking about, like, three panel pages. We're talking more like six or seven, sometimes more. And so there's a little bit more dialogue than usual, but not a lot of, you know. But I found it paced really well and interesting. I mean, I was immediately grabbed by it, just because, I mean, I think, like, the concept is cool to me, but not just like, okay, this is a sure bet for me. But The characterization is really well. It's just really well written. Like I said, Merlin, you get some humor because Merlin is such an ass, and his interactions with Arthur are pretty amusing. And you know, you have your point of view character in Thomas, who at first just thinks that Arthur is a guy that's lost his mind, and you know, but soon realizes that there's something more to go on here. So yeah, I mean, I found myself pretty immediately into it. You know, issue two starts off as the last one ended with, you know, the sword in the stone, and we see that this is being broadcast all over the place, and people are watching on television. But you know, outside the United Nations, there's these huge crowds, and we get a sense of, you know, it's not just the problem of these aliens invading, but like Earth and the authorities on Earth have become a lot crueler. And we get this kind of Kirby concept here, where these Neo men are dropped off, and they're these men in these green outfits who are all bald and kind of look similar, but not exactly the same. Ball, you know, just grayish skin, and the caption explains to us that they used to be criminals. So basically, they're taking like criminals and undesirables and stuff, and they're brainwashing them and genetically engineering them so that they can be used as a sort of violent police force. But they're not very; they're just kind of like a brute force, a brute weapon, because they're not very discriminate. So one is about to attack and kill a mother and child, and this is when Arthur shows up and live on television saves this woman. So this kind of like this is exciting to the people watching. All these like really just depressed people that are past the point of caring and are just given up to their fate start to be awakened with excitement. And it's pretty funny. This reporter who was reporting on the events at the UN walks up with a thin cylindrical microphone and tries to have an interview with Arthur, and Arthur says, "Why would I converse with one who sticks a sausage in my face? Away with you." So, I mean, that's pretty good philosophy to have. It's not talking
sausage.
Stick sausages in your face.
That's so, like Keith throwing Candy Crush at us.
Yeah. Yeah. You just cut him off. But, yeah, so as expected, Arthur walks into the United Nations and plucks the sword out of the stone. And as he does, seven comet star kind of shooting star kind of looking things shoot off from it and into outer space. And they're briefly grasped in space by this huge hand. And Merlin struggles to against whatever this force is that's trying to disrupt the stars. And we next see one of them flying towards this Commander Acton, the woman that was introduced last time. She's relaxing in her quarters, and it collides with her, and she suddenly has memories that are kind of vague that she can't quite recall. And again, sort of amusing moment where Merlin, Arthur, and Tom show up, and they're dressed up. They're disguised in the outfit of these Earth Defense soldiers. So they're kind of like, Merlin kind of especially looks kind of like ridiculous with his long white beard and this and these like red, white, and blue uniforms. But he does the old Obi-Wan Kenobi. I've shown you my identification mind trick kind of thing to get past the guard. And it turns out that you know, when that strange hand grasped the stars in outer space, it briefly interfered with these stars. And so their intention is to reawaken the soul that's dormant in these people. The reason that the memories didn't completely come back to her was because of that interference. So when they arrive, the reason that Arthur and Merlin coming here is to correct that interference. And it turns out that Commander Acton is actually Guinevere reincarnated. And Merlin means to use his magic, but Arthur steps in and kisses her as a way of reawakening her memories. And it all comes flooding back. She remembers being his queen, and she realizes that she's Guinevere and pledges her allegiance. So things wrap up with a final scene where another Knight of the Round Table is reclaimed. It turns out that the other character that we were introduced to last time, the Frenchman Futrell, turns out to be the reincarnated Sir Lancelot. So, and he, being that he's the richest man in the world, his estate is actually a orbiting asteroid that people call Futrell's Fortress. And this becomes the new Camelot. We have a little bit of an ominous ending because, as the legend goes, there was a love triangle between Arthur, Lancelot, and Guinevere. And we see that still exists as Lancelot bows and kisses her hand while Arthur looks on from the background. And on the final page, we get introduced to Morgan Le Fay, half-sister of King Arthur. And she is pleased to see that this love triangle still sustains itself in these reincarnated forms, and that she will be happy to egg that on and push it to keep things in motion and to see her brother fail as he failed before. And that's how things wrap up. So I was pretty impressed so far just about how they made this high concept of King Arthur in the future. It's written really, really well, and the Brian Boland art is nice to look at as well.
I love the art, and here's where the covers are the same as the artist interior.
Mm-hmm. True. Yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah, and I don't know if the cover of this trade is a new piece of art. It looks like it could be. If not, it's the trade has been recolored. It's been recolored, and it's the glossy paper, which, I mean, it's not my preference, but it does look it's a nice trade though. And this is the first printing. I don't think it's been collected before. So, and I haven't read it yet. Well, actually, I'm sorry. It must have been, because the preface that's included, written by Mike Barr, it says it's from the 2008 edition. So I guess it was just out of print for a little while.
Yeah, that one's probably pretty rare.
Probably, yeah. So this is a new.
Well, they have the 2013. Deluxe, the deluxe hard edition too.
Gotcha. Cover.
Wait, does your cover have the Arthur holding Guinevere, or no?
No.
Okay. Does your cover have all of the cast and then Morgan Le Fay in the background with Merlin?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, it looks like. So I did find it in the indicia here. The cover, introduction, sketches, and the compilation of the material is copyright 2008. So it was a new cover for the 2008 edition that they're reusing here.
Ah.
So it's a paperback cover copy, or cover price of $20. So you can probably find it for a pretty good price.
Mm-hmm. I've never read it. I think I've read the first two issues, but this was one of those direct to comic shop.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1983 or 82, whenever this was coming out, I had a hard time getting a ride to the comic shop because it wasn't even nowhere near my house.
Mm-hmm.
So I got maybe three or four issues of it, and I liked it, what I read, but I couldn't make sense of it because it wasn't one of those books where you could like read one and not know right. the story because it's like an ongoing maxi series. So yeah, I got to revisit this guy at some point.
Yeah, so far I can recommend it. I mean, I'm looking forward to reading the rest of it, and I mean, it's coming from. I mean, I find the Arthur legend interesting, but it's not something you know that I've.
It's not Knutson interesting.
Yeah, I'm not as into it as him. I'm definitely open to it, and I do like fantasy and you know swords and sorcery and all that. So it's not a tough sell. But it's not like, you know, I seek out every last thing about King Arthur and all that. I'm aware of the legend, and I've seen some things that are based on it. But I wouldn't, you know, if that's just not something that's you're immediately into, I wouldn't necessarily put it off for that because it's a futuristic setting and it's a pretty neat concept. And they seem to be doing a pretty good job of it.
All right. Well, I have a. Let's see, what year is this? 1967. Thor from Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. Mm. It's inked by Vince Coletta. This is Thor issue 138, 139. I got these from my brother for my birthday. And my brother's pretty creative for getting me stuff that I don't already have, which I don't know how he does, but
yeah, really.
I had mentioned that I mentioned something about Ulick, or I might have posted a picture of Ulick, who's that troll with the pounders on his fists, and I actually have a statue of Ulick because I always liked him, and I don't have too many the Bowen statues.
Mm-hmm.
But if you saw my Bowen collection, you'd be like, wow, that's a weird collection of people. But I have like a Ulick one, and I have it in one of my display cases. And he got me like a couple more appearances of Ulick. So issue 138 is where the trolls are attacking Asgard.
Mm.
And Thor is on Earth and trying to be under disguise, so he goes to his alias of Donald Blake, and you know Thor will drop the hammer and the hammer turns to the cane and he's Donald Blake, and the trolls have kidnapped Lady Sif and they're captured by Ulick. So Ulick is on Earth at the time, and they're trying to win a battle on Earth by taking Thor out so they can win it at Asgard. That's what they're essentially doing.
Hmm.
So the Troll King has Ulick down there trying to take out Thor while they're invading Asgard. And when Donald Blake is there, the trolls are able to sense that he's the one that they're after. And they kind of pull him through the ground using some technology. And they think that they captured Thor because they steal his cane. So they're like, how does it work? You know, we're trying to get the hammer so we could take care of so we can win the Battle of Asgard. So we need the Mjolnir. And he actually gets it back, and the hammer comes back to Thor, and then he's Thor and he's battling Ulick. And then the scene cuts to Asgard, and there's this new character who I've never seen before. This might be the first appearance of him, called Oracle. And his Oracle spelled differently. It's O-R-I-K-A-L. And Oracle is from a different universe, and he's like he created all these fantastic weapons. And they have Oracle imprisoned, the Troll King, so they could the Troll King's name is Gwerdwar, and they have him imprisoned in this like fire pit, and he basically is giving them technological weapons so they can invade Asgard and win the war. And then the scene cuts to the battle, and it's pretty damn awesome. So Thor is battling Ulrich. Ulrich can go hand to hand combat with Thor pretty easy with his fist pounders. Mm-hmm. And Thor runs across Lady Sif, and they have this device, these trolls, and it's like a gravity device, and it sucks in Mjolnir. So when Thor is separated from his hammer at this time, he's got like, I can't remember if it's 60 seconds, but he has like 60 seconds before he turns back to Dr. Donald Blake if he's separated from his hammer. So it's not that long of a time that he could be separated from his hammer. So they steal his hammer in this device. They don't know how to use it because their whole job was to get the hammer. And they escape. And then Lady Sif... So they were just using Lady Sif to get the hammer. Lady Sif is free. And then Thor is like, well, I have no mechanism now to stay Thor, nor do I have any way to get back to Asgard. And he's totally freaking out because they've invaded Asgard, and Odin is even having to be pulled into the battle. And that's not good because Odin usually sits in the background and lets everybody else fight. And then you get a cool little story about the Warriors Three, and that's a backup story that I won't get too far into. But in 139, the battle picks up, and... Sif is like, do not despair. This is where Sif does something that I've never seen her do. She's got like some witchcraft or something. She unleashes a spell that lets them travel to Asgard within the time that he's been away from his hammer. So she teleports them to Asgard. He still doesn't have his hammer. But I think on Asgard, when he's there, he could stay Thor. Do you see what I'm saying? So... Mm-hmm. It's when he's on Earth and separated from it that he turned back. So he actually teleports them back, and as the war's going on, Odin and crew are getting their asses kicked because of all the technology. Thor gets his hammer back. They fight. And what happened here towards the end? Oh, the interesting thing here, too, is that Odin... feels betrayed by his son because he's like, where's my son when I need him the most? But Thor does go conquer the Troll King at the source and returns Asgard back to, and then it's like father and son are reunited and everything's cool. So it was a good issue. I liked it. I obviously like the fourth world art, like Kirby's fourth world art, better than the earlier stuff that he did. Because I think it stands out more, but it is pretty freaking awesome, especially when he draws the trolls. And in the backup, him and Stan Lee do the backups as well, and they're pretty cool because the backup is pretty much a story of Hogan and some of his backstory. They're helping him go find some artifact, and that was pretty cool. But it's good that the comics at this time really have a hook at the end of each issue, because it's really hard to read this issue and just put it down and say, well, what the hell? How do I find out what happens, you know?
They don't want you to stop, you know?
Yeah.
You gotta get that next issue. They want you to keep buying them.
Keep buying them, yeah. So those are pretty cool issues. 139.
I really didn't know her character much until recently, but I've come to really like Lady Sif a lot.
Oh, she's awesome.
Yeah. Must be something like that, like strong warrior females or something. They get her and Big Barda together.
Big Barda and Sif and...
beat us up.
Yeah. Red Sonja is really, really good right now with Gail Simone writing it. That was awesome.
Interesting to see her take that on, and the covers that they're having done for those are awesome.
Yeah, all female covers.
Yeah, the female artists.
I am so torn, and I fought with myself because I've been getting all three covers because I find them fascinating. But when my bill was getting so high, I was like, well, what can I cut? Well, I can cut these variants, and it's just hard to pick one when I like them all for very different reasons.
I think usually when I've looked at them, the one if there's one by Jenny Frizen.
Yeah, those are the ones I'm picking.
yeah, I think those are usually the ones that stand out the most to me.
But this last round was Frizen, Clunin, and Buscema, and I love them all for different reasons. Like, Buscema's got that cartoony look, and then Clunin has, a very similar style to, well, she's got her own style, but she draws them close to, like, Frizen-type style.
Mm-hmm.
But, damn, it's hard not to just get them all, but...
Yeah, I like... Clunin's art.
Yeah.
Her stuff's good. When she did the first arc on the new Dark Horse, new Conan series, that was really... Those are really good... really good issues, really good art. You know, it's a young Conan, and did you read those? Have you read those?
I've read the first arc, but I'm behind on it, but I buy it because I think it's awesome.
It's really good.
It's the Black Queen or the Pirate Queen.
Yeah, and her
great.
Baylet, I think, or something like that. Her Baylet, whatever, is really nice.
Yeah, very amazing.
So, yeah, that's cool. I don't know. Maybe your brother must be, like, hacking your comic base or something just to figure out what you don't have. Or he pays really close attention. He must really look at what you post on Facebook and say that you don't have.
Or lucking out.
Yeah. No, I'm impressed. Well, I haven't talked about it since July. But I read some more Wolverine. I think in the show notes last time it said I covered 9, 10, and 11, but I'm pretty sure that I didn't cover 11. So I'm almost positive, but if I'm wrong, I apologize for repetition. But this is basically, you know, continuation. I talked about the first 10 issues of the first Wolverine solo series. And... they had pretty much been written by Chris Claremont to this point. For this storyline, this is the first six-parter, which was a bit more rare at this time in the late 80s. The artist is still John Buscema, but this storyline is written by Peter David. And it's the Gehenna Stone affair. And I read some of these. I don't think I... was able to finish the storyline when I was a kid. I know I read a couple of the issues, but we get things kicked off with Wolverine's buddy Archie Goodwin, the pilot who's been involved in past issues. They're hanging out at the bar, and Archie tells Patch, as he knows Wolverine, that his dad died and left him $32, and he gave the rest to his brother Bert. His brother Bert has all this money, but their aunt, their dad's sister, is trying to get them trying to get Bert declared incompetent because he's so into movies that he's been known to believe that he's the a character in a movie and to act out the plot of these movies. And so Archie doesn't want this to happen, doesn't want his aunt to get the money, and Wolverine ends up accompanying him to San Francisco, where Archie's family lives. And when they get to San Francisco, they run into Jessica Drew, who's also returned to the city and to check in on her offices and stuff, because she's an overseas as well. So they're surprised when they come to Bert's place that he's actually acting pretty normal. I mean, Archie has them prepared to just expect the unexpected, and he's just kind of acting like Bert, you know, normal old Bert, which seems that Archie hasn't seen him just act like normal old Bert in forever. He's sort of returned to his old profession of being a researcher, and seems like he's on the up and up. But when they leave, we see that he's holding on to this stone, this like piece of like a precious stone that he has hidden away in his desk, and that maybe there is actually something crazy going on with him. Meanwhile, once Jessica Drew's back at her visit, she gets a visit from this guy named Tuttle, who's from the local museum, and apparently he's looking for her help, because apparently these people dressed up like vampires broke into the museum and stole a precious stone. Sounds familiar. And apparently what they stole was a fake, and so she's like, you know, what's the problem? If they stole a fake, why are you worried about it? And he says, well, the thing is, we didn't know it was a fake. Somebody replaced the diamond with a fake before the thieves even got to it. And it's kind of funny, because this Tuttle, he's kind of like a nerdy guy. As he's leaving, he thinks to himself about Jessica, what a healthy young woman. But so we get to court, and Jessica's, or rather, Bert's aunt's trying to get him declared incompetent, and Bert's not even showing up. He's there. Everybody's waiting for him. All of a sudden, he comes crashing through the court window on a horse, dressed like Harrison Ford from the Indiana Jones movies, of course. He's blabbing on about the evil forces of Baal, however you want to say it, are pursuing him. And first reaction, of course, is okay. He's not okay. After all, he's lost it. But sure enough, a horde of undead-looking beings come rushing in after him, and that's where the issue ends. So when we pick up in issue 12 with a huge battle, all these vampire-looking people. Bert's roaming around on the horse. So Wolverine obviously gets in, and Jessica get into the fray, and Wolverine punches one of them in the face, and the fangs break, and he realizes that these people actually have fake fangs and they're not real vampires. The issue goes by pretty quick, because it's a big chase scene, kind of. Jessica jumps on the back of the horse that Bert's riding, and they escape. It turns out that Bert has the diamond that the vampires were after when they broke into the museum. He's the one that replaced it with a fake, because somehow he knew that that was going to happen, so he's trying to protect this stone. They don't know how he knows that, though. To keep up with them, Wolverine and Archie commandeer a cop car and take after them. And it's just kind of a big chase scene, this issue. There's a nice action scene where Wolverine's hanging out the window of the cop car trying to get at the vehicle next to them, and he ends up getting smashed in between the two vehicles as they collide. And there's a kind of a funny moment where there's a guy setting up a new comic book store because his got smashed and destroyed in Las Vegas, I think, in a previous episode. And so he's just putting out the new, like, newly open for business sign, and Wolverine and Archie crash the comic or the cop car into the front of his store.
Well, that sucks.
And then they just show him smacking his head against the door after they leave.
It's not like comic shop owners are rich anyway, you know?
Yeah, it's a tough break. So, it just basically kind of ends with the four of them, Bert, Jessica, Wolverine, and Archie coming back together.
I don't care for the Nolan covers.
Yeah, they're. Yeah.
I'm just looking at the cover, like, if on 11 and 12, if it would be like something that I would gravitate to.
Yeah.
If I saw it on the shelf, and I just don't care for his style.
They're a little weird. I mean, I definitely like the interiors, the Buscema art a lot better. His Wolverine is pretty, not Buscema's, but on the covers, almost kind of demonic looking.
Yeah.
A
lot of not teeth.
Not that that's inherently a bad thing, but yeah, they look, I don't know if the style's suitable. It's not bad art, but...
Even his physique when he's hanging out of the police car looks weird.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a cool scene in the comic, but I'll just cover 13 real quick, because again, it's pretty easy to summarize. In this issue, we basically have two storylines that switch back and forth. One is our main storyline that we've been following the last couple issues, and in that... We get a little bit of exposition from Bert to his companions. He explains that there's this thing called the Gehenna Stone, which we've been expecting because it's part of the title of the storyline. And it comes from, and this is all, a lot of this is taken from like the Old Testament. There's a place called Gehenna outside of Jerusalem where like all the, there's a lot of evil that happened, and just like the dregs of society hung out there and did nasty things, and they worshiped the god Baal, who is also mentioned in the Old Testament, and eventually God had enough and sent a warrior known as the Hand of God to Gehenna, and who destroyed Baal, and his soul coalesced into a stone, which later the Hand of God smashed, and it broke into 100 pieces. And purportedly, the piece that Bert has is one of those pieces. And we also see this being who, all these people that are dressed in like vampires, he has real fangs and claims to be a descendant of Baal. And he has most of the Gehenna Stone intact, but it's missing these pieces, one of which Bert has. It seems that the stone piece that Bert has is having an effect on him because he won't let anybody touch it. He's like, like Gollum, Lord of the Rings, my precious, you know. And the Baal descendant is waiting for Wolverine and his companions at the airport where they're trying to escape. And so there's a, a battle that happens. Archie and Jessica, they're still skeptical of this whole thing. They just think Bert's crazy. But Wolverine is convinced when he comes up against Baal finds that, this being... his fangs are for real, like I said, and he's very powerful. And the only reason he doesn't like rip Wolverine in his hat in half is because of Wolverine's skeleton. So, like I said, there's two plots. In the other plot, it's just this short little kind of story where these two twins show up at a bar and hotel, and they're bickering a little bit. But they're like, we're twins, we shouldn't be fighting, let's make up. And they also have a piece of the Gehenna Stone. So just as we saw Bert acting kind of funny, as throughout the issue, when we flip back to them, they're bickering more and more. And at the end of the story, the owner of the establishment goes up because he hears fighting, and there's actually like some blood that drips through the ceiling, and he goes up there and the two twins have killed each other over the stone. So, it kind of is like a little subplot that illustrates the power that the evil power these stones, these pieces of the Gehenna Stone can have on people. So, pretty cool so far. after the next three issues, I'll know for sure. I think it maybe is a little bit drawn out. Could be a little more concise. But it's entertaining, and I really enjoy the John Buscema art, and I feel like the tone, even though it's switched writers from Claremont to David, stayed pretty consistent. Decided to pick up and read some more Wolverine, and still enjoying it.
That's cool.
Yeah. And that wraps up what I have.
I have one more issue. I read Amazing Spider-Man 125, which is the second appearance of Man-Wolf. So my Man-Wolf love... I'm going to say Wolf. Barb's laughing at me because Alan makes fun of me because I say Wolf. Wolf. Like Wolf. The L is silent.
What a dog says?
Yeah. Wolf. Werewolf, man wolf, wolf.
Man love from man wolf.
Yeah, and it is an awesome issue. Like Jerry Conway, I've always liked, but this is last issue. Spider-Man's almost like super depressed because it's the time where Green Goblin's dead. He lost Gwen. He's like in a really rut. And then Man-Wolf shows up and almost tries to kill J. Jonah Jameson. And J. Jonah Jameson realizes there's a link between Man-Wolf and the son. That it's his son. And he becomes overly protective of the situation, even though he's about to get killed. But this battle continues where he's fighting Man-Wolf. And... It ends up with him getting scratched pretty bad across the chest, which makes him kind of dizzy because he realizes that all he has to do is follow him until the moon's gone and actually find out who it is. But he's too delirious with pain that he has to crash out and fix his put some ointment on his infection and go sit it out. And then MJ is at the coffee house with Flash Thompson and some other guy I've never seen before. Don't know who that is. But he's talking about how Flash doesn't like to hang out with Pete anymore and MJ, everybody because they're becoming so depressed because Gwen's dead and they don't have any fun left in them. And then Harry drops by, who's Norman's son, and he basically tells Mary Jane to get lost, and because Mary Jane tries to comfort him, and that didn't work out so well. And J. Jonah Jameson makes his way over to the apartment where his son is staying, and he finally confronts him and says, you know, what could I do to help? And he actually tells him his backstory, and Man-Wolf was kind of did a like a malicious act when he was on this top secret mission to go to the moon, and he took this rock and never told anybody he had the rock, and he put it on his chest as a necklace. Well, that necklace became grafted to it, like became part of him. He couldn't like take it off. And he tells his backstory how he's driving one night and actually turned to the wolf. And he's been borderline almost killing people if he hasn't killed anybody already. Mm. And Spider-Man goes to talk to Robbie because I guess Joe Robertson is his friend. And he goes to ask him some questions about like he knows he's seen that necklace before, but he doesn't remember where. And he's going to Robbie to try to get... help, and J. Jonah Jameson busts in and they tear gas him, and he falls out of the building tear gassed and shows up to Mary Jane's apartment, and she's nice to him up front, like, I'll let you sit in my apartment, rest up, and then she just starts chewing his ass because she's like, you only come when you need me, and you're never there and all that kind of stuff. I'm not a daycare center, get the hell out. And she kicks him out. And the fiance of Manwolf shows up, and he turns into the wolf and almost kills JJJ again, and then he goes after his fiance to try to kill her, and Spider-Man saves the day, punches out Manwolf, and he actually takes the jewel. He tries to web it and take it off, and it won't come off, but he actually grabs it with his fist and pulls it right off, and he's like, holy shit, that was part, that was grafted to him, because it was like extreme pain when he pulled it off. It was like, he just pulls it off, and he turns back to his son. So that's how that ended. And the next issue says, where stalks the kangaroo? And that, I want to read it, because this storyline is like awesome. I want to know more about this time period of Spider-Man. More so than when I do with Thor, but I totally forgot. I wanted to read this letter from 139. I'll just take a second of Thor, because God, it's so today, as far as people complaining. Oh my God. I was like, wow, that's cool that they published that. Cause they didn't have to publish people's mail back then. Mm-hmm. They could just say, oh, this is a positive one. I'll publish it.
Right.
See if I can find it easily. This is, it says, Dear Stan and Jack, now you've done it. You've blackened the name of Marvel! ! Thor 136 was the worst issue of Marvel Age. The art was fine and all that, but Jane Foster was deserving to be an immortal. You goofed. You say that Odin is all-wise, but he really is unfair. What mortal female can be transported to a world which is unspeakable and stand up to a creature of horror and come out all smiles? And how could Thor change all of a sudden to another girl? I guess he was... he met another woman. Just like that. I felt like giving up collecting Marvels. He's doing a Knutson. I want to stop locking keys over. I'm going to stop getting comics. Me, a faithful Marvelite who has some of your books in triples. Wow.
Whoa.
I'm livid with anger. Who wants a wife that goes around battling unknowns, and compared to Jane Foster, Sif is a rag mop?
Whoa.
Holy crap.
What the hell, dude? I'm getting pissed. I got to write a response letter to send on my... Nobody calls Lady Sif a rag mop.
A rag mop.
Oh, I'm around, mister. I'll track you down on Twitter.
Yeah. I'll find out who wrote that letter. But that was a crazy email.
That's pretty impassioned.
Actually, not an email, a real letter.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that was intense. Somebody, Jane Foster.
Three copies of every Marvel comic, and now he's going to quit.
He's some sort of, like, strange hybrid of the DC Noise hosts.
Yeah. He is. But that was a crazy letter I wanted to read.
Yeah, that's a good one. Gotta love that. Yeah, that. But that Spider-Man period sounds pretty interesting. It's I like the Manwolf seems like a good Spider-Man villain because he's real conflicted. You know.
Yeah.
Spider-Man's always good to have those super villains that don't necessarily want to they can't quite control themselves. You know. Not like they're just straight out to do evil or rob banks or something. They're just out of control.
And he's not like Jack Russell, who could. He has some semblance of. He really turns into the Hulk with. He doesn't say a word. He's a totally animal.
Mm-hmm.
And he especially seems to want to kill whoever he knows for some reason. But yeah. It's cool, and I picked up the last two issues of Creatures on the Loose of the Manwolf series, so I'll be talking about that because I read all of those. So I only have a few issues of Manwolf left besides his current stuff. And I'm all caught up on Bronze Age Manwolf.
Nice. Very cool.
Well, I guess we can wrap this one up.
Yeah, I was looking forward to it and happy to resume and record a new episode of the Retrocast.
Yes, it was a good time. I was glad to read some of these too, because I had,
yeah, you know,
it's my excuse to get away from the main stuff.
Exactly. I mean, it's I like having it as that reminder to sit down and enjoy some old comics, you know.
Yep.
So, now you made I don't know if you want to mention, you made an appearance on a new podcast that's out there by one of our former guests, right?
Yeah, Donnie Salvo has the Sunday podcast, and it's kind of a roundtable of whoever he gets at a very spontaneous moment in time to say, let's record! And I really just wanted to get on because I've never talked to Raphael or Chris Kaczynski, and I wanted to meet them because I've talked to Jim Dietz and to Donnie, of course, a lot of times, and I never got to talk to those guys of No Apologies, and I was like, this is a good opportunity. I have some time, and it was a lot of fun, and it looks like it's a round table of like what you read this week and just spotlighting like stuff you like. So it seems to be like a positive podcast.
Yeah, that's cool. Sounds so cool. I haven't gotten a chance to listen to it yet, but I'm definitely going to check it out. And, like you said, Chris and Raphael are from the No Apologies podcast, and Jim Dietz also is on a Taylor Network podcast.
TV
Nothing's
One.
On. Things On. Yeah, Nothing's On, which also has Donnie and Daryl Taylor, of course. So, yeah, I just thought that would be cool to mention. You can find us on Twitter. I'm MythMakingETC, and Mike is, just drew a blank.
Mike Myers Brunch.
Right. I'm rusty.
It's been that long.
I at least remembered your name, which is almost all of it, all of it, so I don't know why I couldn't remember the brunch part. But your Mike at Comic Book Noise is your email address, and mine is mythmakingetc@gmail.com. Geekbrunchpodcast.com, where you can find our episodes as well as that of the normal whatever you want to call the regular Geek Brunch. There's a Facebook page, which you can like and you know, be one of the of our 17,000 potential audience. If you want to give us $30, we'll promote a post to a few grand. And I think that might cover it. Next time we'll be talking about all Miracle, all Mister, all the time.
Oh, you know what? I forgot to mention, I don't know if you saw this, but we got a comment, I think, on the website.
Oh, yeah?
I forgot to mention it.
I missed that. One of the previous episodes?
Yeah, and I wanted to read it out loud. Because it made a recommendation. It was from Squeaky Will. He just said, suggestion, how about spotlighting a specific well-known character from a chosen era? So without official parameters being set, I'd like to suggest reviewing some Doctor Doom appearances from the 80s.
Mm.
And then he mentions a few issues that he'd like us to cover. And what else did he say? Anyway, that's a little suggestion for future podcast material. Keep up the good work. So he made some recommendations from the 80s about some certain Doctor Doom spotlight issues he'd like us to cover in the future. But it was I think it was on episode 18. So it was the one right before this.
Oh, okay. Very cool. Yeah, let's take a look at that. And
it's weird though, as there was a reply on here from Trenchcoat Mafia, and now the reply is not there, so I don't know what happened to it. But I guess he had reviewed one of the titles and had mentioned that, and it didn't show up as a response. That's weird. I'll have to look into that. Maybe I need to log in as admin and see it. I don't know. All right. Forgot to mention that. I knew there was something I needed to mention and totally spaced it out, and then I was going to go log in. And I want to try to get this episode out soon because I got a business trip this week. So.
Oh, cool. Sounds good. Yeah, well, thanks for the comment, Squeaky Wheel. I'll take a look at that. You know what they say about the squeaky wheel. It catches the worm, right? Or something like that. So maybe we'll do that.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Sounds good. It was good talking to you again.
Three more issues of Mr. Miracle next 12, 13, and 14, I guess.
Yep. Yeah, I think we'll have a couple episodes just all Mr. Miracle.
Yeah.
Which is cool with me.
Yep. It's always good. So you have a good week, and I will talk to you in a couple Sundays.
All right, sounds good.
All right, take care.
Too. Bye. All right, you too. Bye-bye. Just a good old boy, never meaning no harm. Beats all you never saw, been in trouble with the law since the day they was born. Straightening the curves. Someday the mountain might get 'em, but the law never will. Making their way, the only way they know how. That's just a little bit more than the law will allow. Just a good old boy, they wouldn't change if they could. Fighting the system like a true modern day Robin Hood.